Okay, thank you again, everyone, for joining. We're going to start with our first offering today of a CSCPF member-led panel on telechaplaincy. My name is Lily Godso. I'm the president of CSCPF, and I'm so thrilled you could be joining us today. I think this is going to be a rich and informative panel. We have four presenters. And as I mentioned earlier, we'll have time afterwards for a Q&A, discussion, et cetera, on the topic of telechaplaincy. So I have some bios here. I'm going to read them. Our first presenter is Cora Schmidt. She has been serving the Marin Health Medical Center community in Green Bay, California, for almost 17 years in various capacities. She is overseeing the Marin Medical Health Center Palliative Care Inpatient Department and the Marin Health Medical Network Palliative Care Outpatient Clinic. Cora is an ordained interfaith minister with the Chaplaincy Institute, and she is a board certified clinical chaplain and pastoral counselor with CSCPF. Since COVID-19, Cora has gathered extensive experience offering pastoral care, not just to patients and their loved ones, but also to organizations using telehealth as the platform for her work. She has been finding creative ways to connect and build trusting therapeutic relationships in our new normal. Thank you, Cora. Welcome. Thank you for being a part of our panel. The next presenter is Sherry Russenberg. She is currently serving as a bereavement coordinator for the hospice program at Middlesex Health in Middletown, Connecticut. She is a certified grief counselor as well as a board certified clinical chaplain with CSCPF. Through a life-altering health challenge, she blends her experience and training to support those in the process of grief and bereavement in hopes of finding peace and harmony. Thank you, Sherry, for being on our panel. Our next presenter is Liz Munns. She is a board certified chaplain with CSCPF as well as an SEF, a supervisory education fellow. She co-facilitates CPE groups remotely via the Zoom platform with her partner, SEF Susan Shannon, who's with us as well, under the supervision of John Jeffrey, who's also here. Also, Liz is a licensed counselor in private practice in Topeka, Kansas. She specializes in nervous system regulation and the treatment of trauma, anxiety, depression, and accumulated stress. She is currently meeting with clients remotely and hopes today to share her experiences on of transitioning to a virtual practice. And our final presenter is Scott Hogue, who's also a board certified chaplain and a CPE supervisor with CSCPF and is a hospice chaplain with Hope West in Colorado. Scott, did you want to speak more to your background or save it for your presentation?
Unmute, Scott.
Oops.
Rookie mistake. I'm ordained with American Baptist Churches USA and have been with the hospice I work with now for 14 years. That's good.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Okay, you'll be our cleanup hitter today.
Okay.
Okay, without further ado then, let's start. Cora, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Lily, and good morning. Good afternoon, good evening to you. So some of you know me, most of you don't, but I have the great pleasure to be with Lily and John, and where is Katie? Katie disappeared. So over the years, I have gathered a lot of experience, but that I would gather experience in telechaplaincy, that was not part of thought process, because I'm very relational. And if you would have even asked me in January, I said, oh, it's impossible. You cannot have a meaningful, in-depth therapeutic relationship and using the Zoom platform. Well, then there COVID happened, and our clinic and also the hospital changed almost overnight to telemedicine. And that was just something that suddenly arrived. And it was as awkward for me as it was for the patient. And so I fumbled around, just get connected and feel comfortable. And I remember who was definitely my first visit with him, that I turned off the Zoom platform and I said, oh no, I did not connect. I was not happy with my interaction, even though the patient was, but I wasn't satisfied with it because I felt I could not connect with the patient in the manner that I know I can. And so that started my own personal journey around what can I do to make this virtual, and also that I can actually bring comfort to the other person so that we can actually enter the therapeutic realm together. And so, as you see, I have a background of the Golden Gate Bridge, so I started to play around with virtual backgrounds. and found that okay, that's a way into a relationship with another person if I that may help the person to actually connect with me. So it's not my office space, it's not my home space, it is a steady, still picture behind me so that we can actually focus, because I have the entry into the patient's home environment. So to really focus as both of us, I thought for me, it's helpful if I have a still picture behind me and maybe something that represents something that has meaning for the patient. And so I tried that out and it's working like a charm. So my patients whom I had met before in person, it really opened them up to a deeper level to my own surprise. And then for the new patients who have never met me, I've never met them as well, to start extending trust in our interaction. Because as it is, we are picking up so many cues from one another while we're talking, while we are sharing the same space, that in the virtual setting. And so creating new ways, new cues to pick up so that we can enter the relationship of trust. And it surprised me. I'm really open. I'm really transparent. It really surprised me to how deep. You know, we have end of life conversations. We have end of life option conversations. These are not conversations that one enters easily. Not even when we are sitting in the same room. And I am conducting them via Zoom. And patients seem very comfortable. Very, very comfortable. And I have become very comfortable with it. And it required my own creativity, because the Zoom platform, I view it as an extension of me. So how can I make this platform comfortable for me, that it becomes an extension so that the other person feels that in spite of meeting in the virtual realm. So pastoral care has expanded. How do we do that? And it needs creativity. Also, what I have discovered by chance is me tremendously how I am performing, because I see myself on the screen. I see my facial expressions. I see my body language, even though it's just upper torso, but it gives me feedback how I am holding mindfulness, how I'm listening. Am I completely entered in the conversation, or am I distant? I see that immediate feedback through this little window that shows my own image during the interaction. And so the video feedback is built in, which I have wholeheartedly embraced, so that I can really come to true self by paying attention to what I and how I do it. Am I there? Am I present? Because as it is, and you may have the same challenge as well, I sit in an office, I have two computer monitors in front of me, I have two cell phones, I have a landline, I have chats going with my teams. There are so many distractions. And this all goes on simultaneously while so what I've done with that is that I close everything. When I'm seeing patients, I turn off my computer. Mute. I have a sign on the door, please do not disturb. So that, let's close all of you.
Cora, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're just going to mute our video for a little while because it seems like your signal is a little bit tenuous, and we want to hear everything you have to say on this subject.
Okay.
We're muting our video to help the bandwidth.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're not leaving you. We're not all turning our backs on you. It's not a protest.
I'm not saying it personal. Do you want me to stop the video too?
You know, maybe that will help your signal. Yeah, okay.
How is that?
Thank you. So we have about five or 10 minutes, Cora. Whatever.
Okay, will you give me the heads up when my time is
yes, ma'am.
Done?
Yeah.
Thank you. So yeah, so immediate feedback on one's on self-performance, and which one can immediately transform into adjustment, aligning body, mind, and spirit to be present, and having also the setup around you conducive so that you can do what it takes to really focus to in the virtual realm for the other person as well as for yourself. I had recently a patient first time, and she was grieving. She had lost her partner 6 months ago. And then now she has been diagnosed with advanced metastatic cancer. And I saw pictures in the room that she was sitting, beautiful, beautiful pictures. And I made a comment. And that opened her up to the field of belief. And we both, it took us. And she herself said to me, she said, I don't know whether I would have gone to that extent to explore my grief if I would have met you in your office. That said a lot to me. So meeting patients in the home environment is tremendously helpful to how we work with one another. It's the same when you enter a hospital room and you look around and what's there, what kind of personal item do you judge these, what is the meaning, what are the metaphors, all of that. And that goes, that applies to virtual realm as well. So yeah, it's it has become, don't take that wrong, really fun for me, because it really asks me to single time to be fully, fully open, fully present, to enter into the mystery with another person. I would have never, ever assumed that I would say that using the virtual realm as the platform where we meet. So what I can leave with you is have fun with it. Explore it. Don't be afraid of it. Look where you have hesitations that you discover, and find ways to make this realm your own, an extension. And use the self-monitoring little picture up there for yourself. Use that as well to monitor yourself so that you can be there for yourself first and most of all, and then for the other whom you meet in the realm. So, but have fun with it. Have fun and listen to the feedback from your patients. Because I know our palliative care patients are very appreciative that we can continue with their care. And they always laugh when I say at the end of the visit, I said, I'm only a Zoom away. And they're using it. They're absolutely using it. I have also done debriefings with over 50, I think the maximum was 60 participants. I've done several debriefings as a host with the platform. And yeah, it applies, the rules apply the same way. Mindfulness, openness, and attentiveness to who is there and who is looking at you and who is joining your heart and you join the heart of the other. So, yeah. So I'm grateful that I was invited to be a panelist. And if you have questions, I'm happy to answer them now or later. Thank you. Thank you for all that you do. And our service is definitely at the center stage. Through the pandemic and also through the unrest in the country. So, yeah, please practice good self-care as well. Thank you. Namaste.
Namaste. Thank you so much, Cora. I'm glad we could all come together to help you.
You're welcome.
Help the signal, and we appreciate your sharing. Okay, next up, Sherry, are you ready to to share with us your experience.
Unmute. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
Getting better and better at this. It makes me nervous, though. Doing more at home and more with our bereavement groups at the hospital, too, which has been kind of interesting, but it's working out well. It really is. So, hi, everyone. I'm Sherry Russenberger, part of the Middlesex Health Hospice team in Middletown, Connecticut. And I've been with the program for about 16 years right now, and can't imagine not being there. Life is was a gift that was given to me, and I get very emotional when I think about it. But personal experience brought me here, and I had no idea probably back 20 years ago what even bereavement meant. And I won't get into details, but 19 years ago, I had a near-death experience, and having had a stroke and open heart surgery. And it was a calling. It was a calling that I need to go help people and who were at that place in their life. And things just fell into place. And it's just incredible how spirit works sometimes. So I'm grateful to be doing the work I do and be able to be part of this organization. So thank you. What I do besides being bereavement coordinator is also hospice consults for our program. Can you all hear me okay? Okay, good. So what part of my job is, along with one of our supervisors, is going, you know, getting referrals from the doctors at the hospital. This is mostly in-house. There are people that do it at home as well. But we get referrals from the doctors who think that somebody is eligible or should be thinking about hospice. And typically hospice is when there is, to be considered, I should say, when there's a diagnosis of 6 months or less. Not to say that's set in stone, because it's not. But I'm not a therapist. I started as a patient care tech, taking care of patients on the unit after my illness, became unit secretary, and then went back to training for my chaplaincy, and also became a grief counselor as well. So it's part of this process that I am here today. So grief starts when, I believe, when a patient is diagnosed, and grief is invisible. Can't see it. So we can't see how somebody is feeling inside and what they're going through. And some examples of grief are, you know, when a patient is told by the doctor that, you know, nothing can be done for them at this point in time, and that we have to looking at more at comfort measures only because the aggressive treatment of our medicines and treatments aren't going to work anymore. And you know, it's them contemplating now what, you know, what is, I'm dying, and what am I going to do now? And oh my goodness, my family and all the other things that go along with that. Maybe, you know, not being able to attend their daughter's wedding brings grief, or not seeing their grandchildren grow up. These are the things that we deal with. I deal with as a bereavement coordinator all the time. And having been able to do the hospice consultations too, I kind of get a jump on it. And in hospice, we're not only taking care of the patient, we're also taking care of the family. The family is a big part of this. It's one big picture. And again, sometimes it's not the patient that needs the support so much as the family does. And that's what I find very rewarding, being able to walk with them through the 13 months that we follow them after a death and see how they progress along the way. Each week, we have our hospice program. Each week we have an IDT meeting, an interdisciplinary meeting. And part of that meeting, people who are there are, you have our medical director, our nurses, our social workers, our bereavement person, volunteers, volunteer coordinator, spiritual care. We're all around the table. There's about 20 of us every Tuesday morning. Now we're Zooming, which is fun. But we sit there, we talk about each patient that we have on our program. And in the beginning of this meeting, I actually do a little service of remembrance. and you are involved in this. I'm sure you've experienced things like this. But in the beginning of the meeting, I start with a poem or a little prayer. And then we read all the names of those who have died on the program that particular week, whether it's been home or within the hospital. And once, when the name is being read, we put a shell in the vase, in a vase that's at the table, and I ring the chimes as well. And we're there to honor those people who have passed, and we talk about them. We talk about the death, how it went, how the nurse is doing, how the family is doing, who we feel would be the primary care person that we were going to follow after the death, whether it be the husband, you know, a child, maybe the husband and the child, maybe a close friend, whoever their first, their primary care person was. It might be more than one person as well, but for the most part, it's one or two people that we follow. And I go back and create my chart and my follow-up. And I have a team of volunteers, ranges anywhere between 10 to 12 people, that make phone calls each week and follow up with these families for a whole year. And some of them we call periodically throughout the year, maybe four times throughout the year. Some of them we call every month. And we also start the calls with a first call, which typically starts within the first week of the death. And normally it's one of the social workers or a spiritual care person that would make the call, or myself. I do have one volunteer that does first calls for us. But at that point, we kind of see where they're at. And they're normally in the thick of things, having to make the funeral arrangements, having, you know, family around and everything. Then as time goes on, the weeks pass by, now we're looking at, okay, family is now maybe back where they were, back home at their houses, and there's not many friends around, tonight's busy, funeral is completed, it's finished. And now these people are starting to really, you know, feel the disconnect and the anxiousness and the grief that comes along with the death of a loved one. So this is where the phone calls are very helpful to them. And we also send letters to our bereaved family members, letters at the 2-month mark, the 6-month mark, and the 13-month mark. And we have grief groups in the local area as well that are now Zooming. A couple of years ago, was approached by one of the best things we've done. I was approached by a very young woman who was a widow. Her husband had died. She was in her early 40s. They had been married already for close to 18 years. And she said, I can't connect with the bereaved that are in their 70s and 80s and 90s. They live a different life than I do. They, you know, they don't have children at home. They don't still have jobs and mortgages and still a long life to live. She says, can we start a young widow and widowers group? I thought that was a great idea. So we did. And it's been extremely successful. Besides the fact they're tech savvy too. So it's easy for them to Zoom. We do Zoom once a month. And it's worked out really, really well. So I'm grateful for that. Another part of our group or our program is a wonderful remembrance service that we put on in November, which I start planning probably in the beginning of July, and we send out invitations to probably about 1,400 people. Now that list includes the bereaved family members, it includes our doctors in the community, not everyone, but those we know that are connected with us. Our staff, our home care staff, our inpatient staff, our volunteers. We typically end up with 300 to 500 people at this event every November, and it's held at a Catholic high school down around the corner from the hospital. They've been very gracious for, I think it's 36 years this year we've been putting this on. I've been in charge of this for about the last 7, and to me, it's just such a gratifying day. It's a day that brings our community together. It's a day to celebrate those who have died on our program. And mind you, this is just for the people who died the last year. And year after year, we see also people that have been coming back year after year to celebrate the life of those they have lost. Within this program, we have every one of the people who've died on the program are listed in the program. There is a candle lighting ceremony where the name of the person who had passed is called, and the family comes down and they light a candle. And with that, they bring a shell back with them. Now, these shells were actually put in the vase at each week's IDT. So when the name was being called at our IDT meeting on Tuesdays, we were putting a shell in that vase. This vase becomes quite large, or we get a large vase at the service. And people take a shell back with them after they light their candle. It's very healing for them. And you can watch them, you know, take a look in that vase, and they're picking out just the right shell, which is so neat to watch. I love sitting back to watch them and watch their faces as they walk down to light the candle. It's just a very sacred moment. And the smiles that come, you know, when they're passing you by, when they recognize you, it's just, it's a beautiful, very humbling experience. But it's been quite the journey. We also, in that day, have a guest speaker that we asked to come. And typically, that guest speaker is someone who has lost a loved one on program. We invite them. Typically, their loss had occurred a year or more prior, so hoping they have, you know, walked through grief and are at a good place. We've had anywhere from daughters to wives to sons to grandchildren talk, and every speech, every talk that they do is just very moving. And they talk, I always tell people, don't talk about our program, don't talk about how good we are, talk about your experience and how you work through grief, because here you are helping the audience that is there, those that are still maybe struggling and at different places within their grief. So that is one of the ways that we kind of begin a new year and celebrate the year that's passed and celebrate those who have died on our program. So it's been a really good run the last years I've been working through it, and I'm grateful for it. And one of the things to remember about dealing with someone with grief is you're not going to fix it. We can't fix it. We can walk with them through their journey. We can walk side by side with them to help them. And they need to be able to talk and to be able to open up. And sometimes it's difficult for them to do with family. However, it's great when they can do it with family and friends. But sometimes, you know, not sometimes, I shouldn't say it like that, but often family, each person in that family is dealing with their grief differently. And they can express their griefs differently. We've had families of, you know, 10 people come in at times and into the unit. I'm going to speak for that because that's typically where I see our hospice patients. But, you know, every one of them is dealing with it differently. Some are very accepting. Some of them are accepting at all. Some are very angry. Some just sit there and say nothing. And it's very interesting to watch this. We have and we do this at home as well as on the unit, a letting go service. And when someone has, it's often done after the person has passed, but it's also done, I've done it a few times prior to passing, because maybe that patient who is dying just been holding on for a long time, and the family can't understand why they're still with us, and neither can staff, because everyone's different. And it's a letting go service that we do, and the family reads a little bit, the staff reads a little bit, rings some chimes, read some poems, and it's very healing. And it's oftentimes after that that somehow we see a change in the shift of the patient, a change in the shift of the family. And at the end of that service, I always ask to people, you know, where are you at right now? Tell me a story about your loved one. And the stories that come up are just beautiful. And we can hang out for, you know, a half an hour to an hour and just talk. And when they leave, they're smiling and they're happy. As happy as it can be, but grateful for the journey and for us walking with them. So hospice is a great way to reap the benefits of the people who are there to help you, as well as to help you walk through, you know, what's going on in your life, which is very heavy for sure. It's a difficult time. So I did write some notes here. I just want to make sure that I stay kind of on target. One of the things I don't deal a lot with, and that is the loss of a child. Typically, I'm going to say the youngest person we've taken care of on our program is probably about 20 years old, 20 to 112, and that was recent. That was amazing. But with that, we don't deal with a lot of children. And I think that's having more of a draw towards the audience that we take care of, I'm not as privy to the loss of a child. And that's something I don't like to deal with myself. I don't like to think about it. I don't like to even ponder the fact that what if something happened to one of my children or my kids? It makes me cry thinking about it. But how, you know, reading up on this, I see how men and women deal very differently with grief. Men are very, they're for most part polar opposites from what I'm seeing, what I've seen. However, you do that get occasional, you know, crossover. Men seem to deal with loss as more of they have a little bit, I don't want to say an easier way to move on, but they're more loss oriented than they are a restoration to restore themselves oriented like a woman would be. So I've unfortunately, some people will deal with a loss and think that they're getting on with life. And yeah, I'm doing good. You call them on their, you know, first month call. Yeah, I'm doing good. Everything is fine. And I've had the experience of, you know, 6 months later, oh yeah, I'm getting married. What? Oh my gosh. And that is something that, you know, I see more in men than I do in women. Women seem to process for a longer period of time and try to restore what's happened in their life and focus more on the children and those things to them, where oftentimes men will, again, you know, fly and do their thing, which is, it is what it is. But again, everyone's different. And that's where we come in, because oftentimes I'll get the call from that husband who quickly processed the death of his wife and now are at a point where they're not happy in where they're at, you know, a year or two later. And what do I do? Oh my God. And they realize they didn't process that death when they needed to, when they needed to be quiet and still. And that's difficult. And I do feel my heart goes out to people that don't take the time to grieve and to walk through it. There was a great little saying when I first started, you've got to walk through grief. You can't go over, under, or around it. You have to go through it to experience it. And I try to tell everyone that, when everyone that I'm dealing with. So, and the other thing,
I have questions, and I think we're going to have a lot of questions for you later, but we have to move on so just we can have time for everyone, the other presenters.
I didn't realize that 20 minutes went by.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
I was trying to text you the time, but.
I apologize.
You were on a roll, so no worries.
Yeah.
But thank you for sharing that. I'm very curious about some of your things you were talking about, especially like the Zoom meeting grief groups you have and things like mm-hmm. that. So let's get to that in the discussion period.
Very good. I apologize.
No problem. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Awesome.
Okay. Okay. We're going to move next on to Liz. Yeah. Liz, you ready?
Yep. Okay. Hey, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Sherry. And thanks, Cora. Interesting stuff. Can you hear me okay? Okay, great. So I'm an SEF and I co-facilitate Zoom CPE groups with Susan Shannon, and we've actually been doing this for several years now. And I really enjoy the co-facilitation process and love working with Susan. I worked in person at this CPE at University of Kansas Hospital. So when I left and John asked if, and Susan asked if I'd want to join them, I was like, you know, initially, like Cora was saying, online Zoom platform. How will this work? And it's been a great experience. It's different than in person in a way, but we find that we really make great connection. And I've just enjoyed it. And it's great to be able to gather people from different time zones. Sometimes timing is an issue because we are in different time zones, but it's wonderful the amount of diversity and of practice that we can come up with. And it's been really great. Susan and I prefer, and I don't want to speak for Susan so she can contradict at the end, but Susan and I have preferred to keep our group small. So, and that's a personal preference, and we've enjoyed that. And we, but I could also see if you prefer to have larger groups, you know, Zoom has the flexibility. I think it's an extra fee maybe to have the Zoom breakout rooms. So maybe you could do your didactics in, the full room and then breakouts for case consultations or however. So I think there's a lot of flexibility there, group size. We just, like I said, we keep ours small enough. So we have not used the Zoom breakout rooms. The downside, our groups are usually 3.5 to 4 hours, and that's a lot of screen time, as I'm sure everyone's kind of, now that we've gone virtual, might have come across that in their own lives. So self-care, we talk about that, taking breaks, not looking directly at the screen the whole time, standing up if you need to. That's really been the main downside, is the time on the screen. And then we do it, when we do our one-on-ones, a lot of times we'll just do them by phone, so we're not adding on screen time to the week. So really, it's been a real I've just found it a real positive and wonderful experience. So, like I said, we've been on this platform for several years. So I found it really, really wonderful, and the ability to connect with people still. And so it's been great. I wanted to kind of shift focus, and happy to answer questions about that when we have Q&A, but I was kind of going to shift focus to some things that I've learned personally, seeing clients or patients one-on-one since having to go virtual and not being able to meet people in person. And so luckily luckily, I guess, but when this all hit, I became aware that PESI, which offers continuing education, offered an 11-hour telehealth class for free. So via recording. So I signed up and it really learned some really useful things to help me consider making this transition. And I just wanted to speak a little bit about HIPAA compliance. If HIPAA compliance is an issue and important, telehealth-wise, the government HHS has waived the HIPAA-compliant platform during the COVID for people. But like normal Zoom is not HIPAA-compliant. You have to have the healthcare Zoom, which is like $200 a month. Any agreement like Skype is not HIPAA-compliant. FaceTime is not HIPAA compliant. Skype for Business is. They have to offer you a BAA, a Business Associates Agreement. So if they offer that, it's free, then you know you're HIPAA compliant. So, and like I said, they've waived that for now, and I don't know how long that's going to go on. Texting is not HIPAA compliant. So you want to make sure about PHI and your texting could probably be an issue. And I think it's important if you're not using a HIPAA compliant platform to let your patients know, you know, give them the option. This is okay with the Health and Human Services right now, but this Zoom platform I'm using is not HIPAA compliant. Although they do have a lot of encryption, I'm not saying that. but just in the long run, legality wise. However, don't use FaceTime Live, Twitch, or TikTok, any of those public-facing things. Those, definitely not, even without. So some vendors like Skype for Business is HIPAA compliant. There's VC, UpDocs. DoxyMe, I've used that before, and that's free, actually. So you can hop on there and make a free account. They have upgraded ones, but so you can schedule your people, your clients, your patients will get an email and a link, and then they put their name in their waiting room, and you can, at the time of the session, you bring them in, and they are HIPAA compliant. G Suite, if you have a business G Suite, I think it's like the basic plan is $6 a month, and so you can sign a BAA with a G Suite. And your emails are HIPAA compliant. Your Google Drive is HIPAA compliant. They have Google Meet, which is a video platform, which I'm using to see patients because I do have the HIPAA compliant with G Suite. I don't like it as well as Zoom, but, and I don't think it's as good for groups. I'm just so used to Zoom that, but for meeting individually, you know, I haven't had much issue with it. I've talked to people about Doxy and been on it before, and that can be kind of spotty, the free one, but a lot of times it's not. So, I mean, that's something good, I think, to look into. GoToMeeting, I looked at that. I think it's about 13-ish a month, and it has, with that, you can get a business associate agreement. Something called VidHealth. So there are things out there, and there are also HIPAA compliant texting apps, if you're interested in looking at those. I would double check to make sure your liability insurance covers telehealth. And no recording of sessions unless it's approved before, like getting consent before. So for HIPAA compliance and for, you know, between you and your client, ask, you know, I'd get something in writing that they don't record and that you won't record unless you have a prior written arrangement. And so that kind of goes in with, you may consider and you may need, you may not, a consent for telehealth, which kind of lays those things out that, you know, that you're not going to record, that, your sessions are generally confidential. I mean, you can find examples on the internet, but that might be something you consider. One thing that I had not considered, but is a great idea, and is getting a emergency contact form. So imagine you're on video on a Zoom meeting with someone like in your CPE group or with your patient or client, and all of a sudden they have a medical emergency. And where are they? I mean, they could be in a different part of the state. And then you're left going, oh, who do I call? Because they're in Colorado and I'm in Kansas, or there, I would have, you know, what do you do? So if you get an emergency contact form, you can have that right there along with you when you meet with them. And it has like an emergency contact person. It has their local hospital and it has their police department. And then the form can also encourage them, you know, if you're having an issue to call 911 or maybe include the National Crisis Line or the National Suicide Hotline, so that they have those numbers too. But so that way, if something happens, then right there you have access and you're not having to sign off and try to find where they are. And generally I don't keep asking unless someone shows up on a video and I don't recognize the background, and then I might just tell them ahead of time. I might double check with you to make sure that you're still in the same city where you're, we have your emergency contact form filled out. So. So that's something I found important. I think it's important, or I found important, to have like clear communication about what are you going to do if your video platform fails, if you have an outage on one end or the other. So, you know, in front, so everybody knows what's happening. Like, I'm going to call you back, or you're going to call, you know, call me if you want to reconnect. You know, usually mine is, if we have a video failure, I'll call you back and we can decide from there. Do we want to try back on video or do we want to proceed by phone? And so have that kind of laid out so nobody's nervous about how are they going to reconnect with you. And and then what's your policy around technology interruption? Say it interrupted 15 minutes of your session. Are you going to, especially if you're billing, how are you going to compensate, or what are you going to do? So kind of make that clear. And I think kind of more best practices if you're like practicing from home now and you might have other people in the house, or even not using a headset so their voice isn't coming across your computer and broadcasting through the house or through wherever you might be, your office, or maybe having a sound machine outside your door. Minimize distractions in your location. Make sure you have a strong enough internet connection. And I know that's not always possible because of weather and things like that, but as much as possible. And then some kind of concerns I've run across with around health, telehealth, is like, on the other side, does the client have, or your patient, do they have a strong enough internet connection to do video? And if not, you know, maybe phone is the best way. And do they have sufficient privacy throughout the session? So say your patient is also is in a domestic violence, has an abusive partner in the home. What happens if their abuser's hanging around while you're on trying to have a session with them? Or if you're doing spiritual care sessions with a teenager and their parents kind of lurking around. I mean, these are kind of things to consider how you're going to handle these situations before getting into them. And then what if someone calls you and you don't know them and they call you and want some spiritual care, for example, say around a death or something, and they're really grieving and depressed and make some sort of maybe inclination that they could be suicidal, and you do your duty to warn and assessment and decide, okay, well, they're not imminently suicidal and I'll see them. Are you, and they're kind of iffy about wanting to go video. Is that okay? Do you feel like you need to get eyes on them since you don't know them and maybe kind of see, or are you willing to go phone? And can you go phone every week, or you want to keep eyes on them to see how they're looking along that line? I mean, and I think that's personal preference, but I think those are things to consider. And I'm sure you all have run into your own. So, but yeah, but overall, I think it's been great. And I can imagine, I think it's been opening up a lot of opportunities for people, like in, especially like in rural, counties, rural areas that might not have a lot of access to spiritual care, maybe having to wait a longer time, or maybe the access they do have to spiritual care in their area isn't the, maybe they prefer a different type of provider that wasn't open to them, and now you've got this availability, which has just really opened up a lot of things. And I just think it's probably, I don't see it going back. I mean, I think this is where we are. And even when we are able to go, maybe people are back meeting in person now, I don't know. But I think even when we are able to go back, this is going to be continuing. And yeah, I think the main issues I've seen are privacy around, I've seen some drop off. And it's mainly with people who are young adults and living at home, and they just don't have the privacy, or feel like they don't have the privacy to talk on the phone or video. Some people will sit in their car and do it, but it's getting really hot now. So, I mean, there's another, you know, privacy is a big issue, and it's summer, and video in a car if you don't have strong enough bandwidth, if you live in an apartment and you're way out in the parking lot, you know, eating up your data, things like that. I mean, these are all kind of things that have come up, but overall connection wise, it's been not internet connection wise, but just being able to connect with people and continue being able to serve has been really positive. And I'm not seeing people in person yet, and I haven't had anybody say any pushback yet. So it's been surprisingly helpful all the way around. I don't know if I have any more time left, but that was kind of what I wanted to share, was kind of the HIPAA aspect and privacy, and just kind of giving some words and thoughts around that that you might want to consider.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Liz.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.
Yeah. All righty. Scott, how you doing?
Doing well, and it's a privilege to be with all of you here in Western Colorado and Grand Junction. It's thundering outside and raining. I work for a hospice that has three offices that covers a north-south ratio of about 150 miles, and then we're right between the Rocky Mountains and the Utah border. And we work with, we have an 13-bed inpatient center, and then we have community chaplains who work specifically in going into people's homes or going into nursing homes or assisted living. And there's reasons for that, building relationships. And I've worked in all three areas when we were a smaller organization. We now have 7 full-time chaplains and 2 variable chaplains. And I work primarily going into people's homes. So one day I'm visiting, and then the next day I was told we would work from home. And that was took some adjusting. One of our managers, our senior director, said, what we've done in the last 3 weeks would usually take about 10 years to come to grips with and adjust to, and we had to do it lickety-split. And so I wanted to share some biases I had about telehealth, then also the mechanics of that, some surprises, and then what I'm going to plan to do, taking what I've learned now forward. We're in a place that has a low infection rate for COVID. The areas around us that have a higher rate were areas that had skiing, like Telluride or Aspen. And so people from out of state, out of country, were coming over the holidays and later, and that's where we see most of the cases. Right where we are, we don't, so we're able to go out to the houses more immediately than otherwise. But I did telehealth for about 10 weeks. And still with some folks, they don't want extra people coming in to see them, so I'm doing telehealth with them. It was very difficult on our patients who and families who were used to volunteers, CNAs, nurses, social workers, and chaplains visiting on a regular basis, and suddenly everybody cut back. And I still smile that chaplains and social workers being non-essential, but even the nurses had to cut back to cut down on the chance of bringing in infection. So the biases that I went in with is that it's not real spiritual care. I know, I did. And then I read some, but I thought, this is my reality for now, and what can we do with that? And I read 2 articles that were supplied by some great managers about, one was written by a chaplain at a hospital in Manhattan, who this hospital had a majority of the COVID cases at the time. And then by a chaplain who was a hospice chaplain in Boulder, Colorado. And the New York City chaplain wrote that he wasn't allowed to go into the COVID unit anymore. And so he would stand outside with his hands on the walls, or she would, and pray. But what happened was, is she found that she had this tremendous spiritual care opportunity with families. And she didn't meet the families because they weren't allowed to come to into the hospital. So she met with them over the telephone. And she talked about how she did that and the frustrations with it. And that I thought, well, okay, that's a tougher spot. And they're making it work. And then the fellow in Boulder talked about, as a hospice chaplain, to nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities, how he's found a way to connect with patients' families. The majority of his patients had dementia and confusion, so they weren't good with talking even on the telephone. So I thought about the four agreements, and the last agreement, it's a book by Ruiz, and it's we do the best we can. So I thought what I do with this is that here's my reality, I'm going to do the best I can with it and trust that good will come out of that. And good did. And it was frustrating at times, and yet it was surprising. In regard to, we even have now, when we chart new codes, telehealth audio, telehealth video, telehealth or in person, it just changed radically. And the part for us is living out here in a more rural area, as Liz said, is that sometimes the internet is sketchy. And so, and then we live with a lot of folks that aren't into the newfangled things. And so we did a survey of all 400 of our patients. Would you be willing to use Zoom? Would you be willing to do that? Do you have the capability? And we just didn't have the time for our IT people to go out into every home. And we didn't want that because of the possibility of infection. Well, the hospice I work for bought a number of tablets, and the nurses took those tablets into the nursing homes where families aren't allowed to visit. And they Zoomed, and they found that for the patients with dementia and Alzheimer's, it wasn't beneficial. It was confusing to them to see people talking to them on a tablet rather than in person. But it was very beneficial for the families to see their loved ones because they can't go in, and then they hear stories. The more you visit the nursing home, the more your family loved one will be better treated. And so they can't go in. They don't know what's going on. They get the reports from the RN for hospice or from the facility staff. So those telehealth, that was beneficial for family to just even have a scan the room and see their loved one and wave and say hi. As far as telehealth from home, the best we could do for the majority of the time is when we got a new admit, the nurse would go in to visit the patient, you know, totally goggled, face shields, the whole deal, and then would Zoom on her phone so that the patient and family could see their social worker and their chaplain, so we weren't strangers when we called. And we just had to accept that and work with it and do what we could and trust that good would come out of that. There's some loss of body language. You can't read the nuances in body language, or if a patient is speaking on the telephone or on a Zoom, there's somebody sitting beside them, as was said before, who might love them but rolls their eyes. And we can't see that. Or the patient's telling us something and suddenly we hear, "Mom, you know that's not true." So it's a little more difficult, and you adjust with that as well. But what I did try to do is to read nuances and tone and voice and the tenor of the voice. The majority of my calls ended up being audio or on the telephone. So those were the good, and the good piece was good did come out of it. That we did the best we could, and because we were doing it with the right heart and mind to provide spiritual care, good things came out of it that we can use now, but also later. And the frustration was we had to redefine what spiritual care was, like spiritual silence, reading body language. We had to look for other avenues of communication and reading a person's state of mind. And then the mechanics. I can't tell you how many times I was using spiritual silence that first week. And then the person said, "Well, I guess you don't have any more to say, bye," and hung up. And I'm going, no. We deal with all ages, from pediatrics to people in their hundreds, but folks that are older, I'm 60, in my 60s, will remember that it costs money to talk on the telephone. And so if there's silence, well, you're done with the call. It's over. There's nothing more to do. This is costing money and people and their time. So what I did is I adjusted, and what you might think of doing is you set some ground rules at the beginning of the conversation, whether it's Zoom or whether it's video or audio, is you say, now there's going to be times where we don't talk. And that's okay. It doesn't mean you don't have anything to say. It doesn't mean I don't have anything to say. We just got to think about what's just been said to give folks, especially older folks, well, even younger ones who are used to texting and all, is to give them permission to have that silence. And the second part of the mechanic is that people sometimes are slow talkers. Like I always thought about Seinfeld had episodes, close talkers and fast talkers. And I thought we should do one on slow talkers, is that they'll say something. And it reminds me of that Zootopia, that movie where the sloth works at the Department of Motor Vehicles and it takes all day to get a license read, is that they'll talk very slowly and then they finish and then they have some more things to talk about before they're going to talk more. And when you're in person with them, you get a sense of that. But I was meeting people I had never met in person before, new patients, and so they would be quiet for a period of time and I would start to talk, and then they would start to talk, and then I'd apologize, then they'd apologize, then I'd say, no, go ahead, and then they'd say, go ahead. And it reminded me of reading or listening on the radio, that radio interviewers have a very good gift of letting that hang for long enough to give the person to talk next. They don't step on their guest's toes regarding silence. So I had to learn to let that be. And that was uncomfortable for me because on the phone you talked, or the conversation was winding up. The other part, and you all have addressed this, is the mechanics of it. If I did a Zoom visit and I was at home, I had to sit in the living room. So I did use earplugs. My wife works for the same hospice, but we still have to be careful of HIPAA across different teams. I'm not supposed to know what this team's doing, and et cetera. So she would be somewhere else. And finally, it got to the point, if I knew it was going to be a call and there's going to be interruption, I would drive into our building or office, find a place where nobody was, and then use their Wi-Fi. And I talked to IT about it, and they said, where you live, it's sketchy. And they were overwhelmed. I said, well, thanks. That was very helpful. I'll come back to you guys again. And they said, anytime. And then another piece of the mechanics is to be careful. You have a plan of care, and in our plan of care, it says telehealth 1 to 2 times a month per chaplain, 1 to 2 times a week, or whatever it might be. Because you think, wow, I'm not driving all these miles in between homes. I'm not going up in the mountains or out in the desert so to see somebody. So I've got plenty of time to make conversations. And what happens is I can remember making 8 to 10 calls and I was just exhausted. And I would just sit there after each call and I would process it. And then I think, I got to chart this. And I think, no, I'll chart it later. So then I have 10 charts to fill out. And so look at your energy level when you're doing these kinds of calls and being careful to not exhaust yourself, because then by the end of the day, who gets the less of you? It's the last person you talk to. In fact, my wife said, you need to do some things that you did while you were out in the community. So at lunchtime, instead of using that time to call or coming and making a sandwich, go out and drive around or go through a drive-through Taco Bell and get something and then sit outside somewhere. Reestablish some routines that you had before that helped you then. And one of the things I had shared before is that I like to go to places for lunch and sit there and eat and listen to other people talk. And they're talking about work, they're talking about the sports. I'm not eavesdropping, but they're just talking about normal everyday things in the middle of my day where we're talking about end of life or dying or anticipatory grief. And it refreshes me. So look for those opportunities to, instead of sitting in the house all day or at the office, to go somewhere and establish some kind of routine that you had before and could continue. And though I'm sure you might have some other thoughts on the mechanics of it. And then the surprises. The first was, I was grumpy one day, and another chaplain, we would call each other and say, how's it working for you? How's it work? What are you guys doing? How does this make it work? And we actually got closer because we don't see each other very much. And one of our chaplains works 100 miles away from where I work. So we got some tips. And one of the chaplains, he was a community chaplain. He said, people that have declined spiritual care or chaplain visits are open to me calling on the telephone. Are they open to a Zoom visit? And we thought about that, and we're still working out why, but it's less threatening. And so he started calling people. That's my timer. He started calling people, and I started doing that, and it worked. And now that I'm going out in the community, those folks I still call. So as one patient said, we want to get to know you, so when that day comes, we'll know who each other are. And I do get called, and we know this, by families that want someone who declined chaplain but now want a chaplain to say a prayer or to be present. Or the nurse might call and say, there's some family dynamics here and we need to work through this. But that way, even if they say no, that's okay. They know who you are. Remember one lady I called and I said, hi, I'm Scott. I'm the chaplain with Hope West. Just calling to check on you. And she said, yes, please have the chaplain call me. I said, I am the chaplain. She says, thank you. Yes, have the chaplain call me. And that went on for 5 minutes. And then I caught a clue and said, yes, I'll have the chaplain call you. And next time I'm going to say, I'm the chaplain, and just go right into it. So then there's some folks who just won't talk. And so you notify the nurse that's visiting and you work together for them to help with spiritual care. And the folks that don't talk, I found, are people that had careers where they spend a lot of time alone and they work things out in their own head. And that's ranchers, farmers, truck drivers, people that just had long stretches of solitude. And you'd call them and you'd think, I'm gonna get 5 minutes out of this. And if you got six, you were happy. And so rather than try and change them, you work within their context and work with the nurse and make that happen. All but two of the 80 patients that I'm responsible for have said don't do in-person visits because they're concerned about the COVID. So what will I do in the moving forward is that the bulk of the visits, of course, when all the restrictions lift, will be in person. But should we have a second wave, I won't be overwhelmed like I was this time. And we as chaplains are going to say, we can still do good from where we are. And then the second is that I'm going to continue to do phone calls, especially for family members where I go in the house and I visit with the patient, but the family member doesn't talk much or doesn't have much to say or uses that time to run an errand. I'm going to call them on the phone and follow up with them and use that as for spiritual care because it's been effective before. I don't like it, but as you all said, it's something that's here and we're going to have to use it for good because there's not a choice to do that. But I'm still finding my way and I'm done. Thank you, Lily.
Thank you so much, Scott. Thank you to all our presenters, Cora and Sherry and Liz and Scott. Thank you. This has been a very wonderful panel and lots of good information. Now at this time, we're going to open it up for questions and more discussion on this as we have the energy for. This is quite a lot to take in. So yeah, where should we start? Does anyone have any questions? You can go ahead and raise your hand and I can unmute you. Deborah, you can unmute yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, I just have a comment. When I was listening to everyone speak, the hospice I work for was very slow to pivot. And now that we have pivoted, I think that chaplains are so resilient and so able to get their head around what they have to do to get to these people to either, I do bereavement work. So, you know, it's, you know, bereavement, talk to the families, talk to the patients, no matter where they are. And as I was listening to everybody talk, I thought to myself, I said, this is the most resilient group of people on the planet, because you know, we're all over the place, even though we're considered non-essential, which I have to laugh about too. So, you know, it's, I really was impressed. And I was going to ask Sherry, what is a bereavement person when you do your bereavement memorial services, you know, in the year, are you going to do something via telehealth this year, or will you be still doing your in-person?
Great question. We're for the most part right now contemplating what we are going to do. I know that each year what we've it's a big part of our program is we ask families to send in pictures of their loved one. Mm-hmm. And it goes onto a DVD orchestrated with music and name scrolling and everything. Of course, we've got legal paperwork that I need to fill out for it to be up on the screen. But I definitely want to do that as well and have some type of a, you know, live on the computer or something they can go back to and refer to maybe within our webpage that they can watch if we're not able to meet. And if we are able to meet, maybe even separate it into two, you know, different events, mm-hmm. Obviously being, you know, mirroring each other, but having people be, you know, apart. It's a big audience. It's a big facility. So you might be able to do that. So we're right now, we're actually in the midst of getting ready to meet and see what everybody's ideas are. Okay. So different than the past.
Yeah. Well, we usually meet in a park here. So, you know, at that time of year when we do ours, the weather is actually nice and almost cooperates here. So no hurricanes, it's past hurricane season and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, you know, we're in the same place. I need to get my team together and think about what we want to do for this year and how we're going to handle it. Of course, I guess some of it will depend on if there is a second wave come through.
You know, remember here in New England, it could be snowing, it could be 70 degrees, depends on the weather. Okay. It pray that way for sure. Yeah.
In Southeast Texas, we don't normally get snow. Yeah. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Scott, Jacqueline had her hand up first. Can you? Okay. Go ahead, Jacqueline. You got it there? Okay, Susan.
There you go.
Okay. There you are.
Yeah, there we
hey.
Go.
Hey.
Hi. Sherry, I just wanted to share with you that I have personal experience with a man who failed to move on after the death of his wife. I mean, like, he moved on to dating, but emotionally he was still stuck. And it was a personal relationship. And what I found was that he was trying to, I never met his, I mean, he didn't want me to meet his friends. And I think it was really kind of like an unconscious thing. Like the friends he had with his wife, I didn't see it as I'm really moving on, but somehow I got the feeling he felt he would be disloyal if, you know, he did the things some of the things with me that he enjoyed that he did with his wife. It was a really kind of difficult and constricted relationship because his circle of friends, he couldn't bring me into the circle of friends that he had enjoyed with his wife. And when I talked to him about it, it was like he couldn't see it. And there was also the question of whether or not I wanted to be in that circle of friends, but I didn't get the sense that he was being conscious about moving on. Am I making sense?
Most definitely. I think when somebody gets to that point, I've always said to people, you know, when, yes, we follow them through bereavement for the year, whether routine or complicated, but also too, when you get really into the depths of things, it's best that they go and talk to someone, a professional therapist, and really work through what's going on for them. I think it's difficult for the other person because you see maybe the potential in a relationship, whether it be just a friendly relationship or something more. But being open with them, I think it was good that you were open with them and were able with him and were able to, you know, talk about your feelings. And you know, everyone's different, and we have to somehow be able to be that and support him, you know, and in his feelings.
And I think when you say, like, for him, going to a therapist was a no-no. You know, we're talking about somebody in their late 50s or early 60s, an African-American man. You know, we're not doing therapy. So a larger question might be, how do we help men grieve when they come from backgrounds, like you mentioned cowboys. I believe Mr. Hogue mentioned cowboys. Or truckers, how do you help men grieve when, you know, that's not part of the masculine culture that they are in? You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's different until somebody wants to go through it. You can't force them.
Oh yeah, I would never. I don't do that. No, I'm not a person that forces people. But I mean, there may be some kind of way of structuring things so that it's more friendly, more male friendly. Mm-hmm. For example, I work a lot in my regular job with assisted training people to be administrators of assisted living, and one of the things that we do when we try to make the when we reduce suicide risk and we try to make the facility more friendly, you know, one way to do it is recognize the signs of suicide, but the other way is to make the facility more engaging and make people more connected, so you lessen the suicide risk that way. And one of the things we have to remind, you know, one of the recommendations that is out there, put out there by the federal government in their toolkit, is to have more activities for men that would attract men. They don't necessarily exclude women, but in settings like that, men can be more isolated because it might be geared more toward women. So in terms of hospice, I would just be more interested in how you might engage men, you know, rather than, you know, hitting them with a hammer, but how you might be more engaging.
We offer a lot of educational programs, which of course they're invited to. The majority of the audience typically is women. You might get one or two men that show up, and I always feel, you know, I'm hoping they don't feel like they're, you know, the outcast because they're not in, they'll often sit in the back of the room, or sometimes you'll get the ones that sit right there and are completely engaged, but they're not as many, I think. You bereavement people out there, how do you feel about that? How does that resonate with you? Would you feel the same way? Does that happen with your groups?
So, oh, I, yeah, I just want to be mindful too that we'll have like less than 10 minutes more for a discussion. And I think you opened up a big topic, and you know, I'm thinking too, like, how do we handle this, you know, now? I mean, already it's such a challenge, and then how do we try and bridge this gap, you know, while now with technology being, that we're becoming so much more technology dependent. So it's a very big, very big field there. I know that Scott wanted to say one more thing, and just wanted to see if there are any other questions that we do have. Cora says she just had to go off soon, so if anybody has any questions for her, so just want to put a little bit more container on this, and then we'll come back to it if we have time. Scott, you were going to say?
One of the things I wanted to add, and it doesn't have anything to do with telehealth, is that to be aware of your staff and how you can provide spiritual care to your team, your bereavement people, your nurses, the CNAs, the social worker. And so our management said, you know, we've got people melting down, and they asked the chaplains, what can you do to provide spiritual care? And they asked the bereavement department that, and the chaplains. And so we put on some hats of figuring out ways to connect with our staff on a regular basis that we hadn't done before. Especially for if you're working as a low ranger. That's what I wanted to say. Thanks.
Thank you. Lily, in the same, may I just add what Scott just said? We also do that. We really pay attention to the staff, and what I have been doing with my staff, I check in every morning. So all my staff works remotely. Comes in the clinic, and every morning at 9 o'clock we have a check-in, and I also do that with other departments. That I extended that to other departments. So I have regular check-in with departments to keep the mental health component, you know, to be at the pulse of that, because it is not easy for all of us. And what we also have discovered is that for individuals who work remotely, there is an isolation factor that comes in. Even though they're working, but being at home adds that disconnect to the organization. And so by checking in, we are bringing them back into the organization and allowing them to feel still being part of it, and instead of being a lone ranger out there. And within the hospital, it's the same thing, so that chaplains are walking through the units, or we're doing it also via Zoom at the end of the day for staff.
Thank you. Barbara, and Deborah. Barbara and Deborah, who wants to go first?
Hey guys, I just have a question for Sherry out of curiosity. Is there a reason why you use shells? Is there some symbology to the shell?
It's the one of the symbols of life. I have a whole write-up on it, and I apologize for not being right on top of it. But to me, it's, you know, the ebb and flow of the sea and the shells being a part of life, and what's inside the shell is important, like what's inside of us. And so there's a lot to it, but.
Well, maybe you can share what you have written up if you care to.
I would love to, yes. I don't have it on me, of course, but I will definitely send it to you.
And also, Scott, you said you had two articles. If you would share them, that would be great as well.
Yes, I can email them to Lily, is that all right? And then have it sent out.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I also want to mention that I have a whole write-up on how to improve your connectivity to improve the speed and the reliability of your internet at home or at work. It's a whole fact sheet that was put together by one of our members to share. So at the conclusion of today, I'll be sending it out to everyone just as another helpful supportive tool as we go into this new world, not so new world, new to us world of technology. Deborah?
Yeah, I just thought I would offer since there's only about four or five of us that are allowed to come in the office now, everybody else is working remotely. What I started doing was, in order to check in, is I started offering a guided meditation twice a week at different times so that people could come, you know, and just take a moment to breathe, and we run through a guided meditation of peace or, you know, whatever we're working with at the time. So that has been very popular because it gives people just a moment to stop and to connect up and to say, okay, I can do this again, and I can do this again, and I can do this again, because our people have been just working like maniacs out, and, you know, it's not stopped, because we get a lot of patients that come out of the hospitals here. So, you know, it's just a moment. It just takes a moment, 10, 15 minutes, and then they're back on the road doing their thing.
Nice.
Well, I was wondering if there's anything else for our panelists that are still here. Any other final thoughts or comments that anyone has? Elise?
I have a comment. I'm really grateful to hear what everybody's doing. And locally, the hospice that I will be volunteering at, they're still seeing everybody in person. They're doing full PPE and are full bore on. And
Can you tell us where that is?
That's in Taos, New Mexico. So yeah, I was just on a meeting with them a couple of weeks ago and hearing, you know, that they are full on in person. I don't know if that's still true 2 weeks later, because our COVID spike came up in the last couple of weeks. So anyway, interesting.
Thank you.
Oh, and with that, so much of the people that I would be seeing because of work in homes, home health in the past in Southern Colorado, and not so much here in Northern New Mexico, but most of the people I see don't have the technical setup to do Zoom, but they do have telephones. So just my own thoughts revolving after listening to everybody. So.
Thank you. Well, I just want to say thank you again to everyone. I think this is a part of a longer conversation. I think this is something we're going to be revisiting again and again, as an organization, a group of members, keep the conversation going in your practitioner communities. And I'm going to open a forum on our website to help us keep this conversation going. You know, so many of us in so many different placements are having similar but varied experiences. I think there's a lot here to share, a lot of wisdom. And I see us as really being leaders in telechaplaincy. We've been meeting for many years on the Zoom platform. We're all quite experienced, and I never thought that this would be a part of the norm now, and it's turned out to be just that. So again, thank you for your participation and your open-mindedness and willingness to be here. We're going to take a break now until noon. And those who are interested in coming back to be a part of our small group breakout, please come back. And blessings to you all. I'm going to stop the recording now. Thanks a lot. See you soon.